But in spite of the fact that even Mussolini himself, although he was later to trumpet fascism again as the antidote to Bolshevism, despite the fact that Mussolini himself admitted that this was not the case, again, the American press, the American news media, continued to parrot the official Mussolini line of fascism as the effective antidote to Bolshevism. Seldes writes of this as follows. But popular opinion, and the bankers, needed a St. George and therefore refused to accept St. George's own admission that there was no Bolshevik dragon for him to kill in 1922. Popular opinion, therefore, finds consolation in those American economists, literateur, and philosophers of the daily press and weeklies which boast readers by the millions. One of these writers states that ruin impended. Mussolini took the short and unconstitutional cut, which is the dictatorial way. He smashed precedents, turned red terror into white fear, and brought order and, what was even more important, economic revival out of the dust and din of class war and political bicker. In the last analysis, fascism is not only a political force of historic moment, but it has been the impetus of an impressive commercial renaissance as well. This same political economist precedes this statement with an unqualified declaration that, quote, the traditional parliamentary systems of Europe are failures, unquote, and a suggestion that France should join the dictatorships. It is true that the same writer in 1938 all his praise of dictatorships, but he remained the agent of the Italian Bolshevik myth. He wrote, quote, Sovietization, with its attendant social and fiscal dislocation, impended. The workers had seized the factories and all the important productive centers. Chaos loomed. In the darkest hour, a strong man rose up and saved the day. The stern will of Mussolini, reinforced by the cohort of black shirts, imposed a regime that made for historic rehabilitation. Dictatorship achieved its best. Another writer, a more flowery one, believes that, quote, everybody who has looked into the fascist movement in Italy has agreed that it was a greatly needed movement and that it saved the nation from descending into a chaotic whirlpool of communism and a financial disaster that would have made Niagara's whirlpool look like a placid puddle of rainwater in comparison. This is, incidentally, the same historian who glorifies Cesare Rosso as the hero, who defends the castor oil treatment and who tells Americans that, quote, in spite of his, Mussolini's, many changes, there has never been a word uttered against his absolute sincerity and honesty, unquote, and that, quote, Mussolini's dictatorship is a good dictatorship, unquote. Again, although it's not a precise analogy, that reminds me in some ways of former Reagan UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick's distinction between totalitarian regimes, i.e. dictatorial socialist regimes, which she condemned, and authoritarian regimes, i.e. dictatorial right-wing regimes, which she, in effect, condones. She distinguished between the totalitarians and the authoritarians. And again, in traditionally, America has found right-wing dictators a good deal more palatable than left-wing dictators, even desirable. The last aspect of the mythology of Mussolini's Italy that we're going to look at here concerns one of the least important and perhaps the best known of the many pieces of mythology propagated about Mussolini's Italy, namely the myth that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. In the first place, it should be commented that the notion that Mussolini made the trains run on time is due to a couple of things. First of all, a misunderstanding of Italian history, and also, I think, to a certain extent, anti-Latin bias. People have been made familiar with Italian jokes and the notion that somehow to be Italian is to be incompetent. That, I suspect, is an aspect to the view that Mussolini made the Italian trains run on time. Also, it should be noted that the Italian rail system did undergo tremendous dislocation during the First World War, because basically priority was given to routing troop and munition trains to the front. This caused tremendous dislocation in the Italian rail system. Now, the regime that followed the First World War and that preceded Mussolini, the liberal regime, basically undertook a five-year program to successfully restore the Italian rail system, which it did. Mussolini then took credit for that, and by giving priority to the express trains, which the tickets for which were more expensive and which were patronized by foreign journalists and dignitaries, by giving priority to the express trains, he actually decreased the service on some of the lower-priced lines. So that Mussolini not only didn't make the Italian trains run on time, the disruption from the First World War in the Italian rail system was accomplished by the liberal regime, but in fact by routing the express trains, which were frequented by foreign journalists and dignitaries, over the other trains, the lower-priced trains, which were patronized by most Italians, he basically screwed the rail system up somewhat from what it had been. And again, I mention this not because in and of itself it's a significant detail, it's perhaps one of the most minor aspects of Mussolini's Italy, but it's one of the aspects that has survived most durably. One always hears about how Mussolini made the trains run on time. Well, he didn't. That also is a piece of mythology, one tragically that has survived, and we're going to go over that right now. Of the mythology, or of the myth, I should say, of Mussolini making the Italian trains run on time, George Seldes writes as follows in Sawdust Caesar. Least important and most quoted is the argument that the trains run on time. The vast American tourist class, which includes bankers, editors, senators, and representatives, mayors and mayoresses, army officers, and just plain folks, quote-unquote, return to its native land where railroading is an accepted institution but not necessarily a yardstick for patriotism and roared in unison, "Great is the Duce. The trains now run on time," unquote. A poor, simple, naive minority which protested that some abstract and old-fashioned American things such as liberty of the press, freedom of the individual, equal justice, and the spread of culture were being slaughtered by the corporate state, where an institution known as the OVRA exercised dictatorial terrorism, was squelched with a complete answer, quote, "But the trains run on time," unquote. When the unruly minority timidly suggested that the authoritarian state was the complete antithesis of the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the rights of man, millions of tourists would leap up to chant the litany, "The trains run on time," unquote. The official press agents and the official philosophers of the fascist regime explained to the world that the running of trains was the symbol of the restoration of law and order. Order, discipline, hierarchy. No one has bothered to explain that the short period of railroad disorganization occurred just after the war when Italy, in order to keep the troop and supply trains running, tore up the rails in many parts of the kingdom and was forced to neglect roadbeds and repair work everywhere, and that immediately after the war engaged upon a railroad reconstruction program of 5 years, which resulted in June of 1922 with enough success to, quote, "make the trains run on time," unquote. A claim of the liberal regime. The liberal regime thoughtlessly hired no press agent and no international bankers to publicize itself. Skipping down. Do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? By the way, I should interrupt to say that Mussolini stationed armed fascisti on all of the trains to help motivate the railroad employees, also to keep them from striking. Again, resuming Seldes's narrative, do the railroads always run on time under fascist discipline? An investigation during a fortnight in July of 1930 made, despite the fact that the press was forbidden to mention railroad accidents and delays, disclosed 5 cases. The Milan-Chiasso Express was derailed at Saragano, 2 of the crew being injured. 2 days later, the train carrying the Honorable Minister of Justice Rocco was derailed and arrived many hours late. On July 22nd, the Rome-Milan Pullman was derailed at Targuini. On the 26th, the locomotive and 14 coaches fell into the Maduna River near Udine, and there was one other derailment of small importance. It is true that the majority of big expresses, those carrying eyewitnessing tourists, are usually put through on time. But on the smaller lines, bad rail and bad road conditions frequently cause delays. Wrote Monsieur van der Velde, noted Belgian foreign minister, after a trip to Italy, quote, "The time is no more when Italian trains run on time. We always were kept waiting for more than a quarter of an hour at the level crossings because the trains were never there at the times they should have been passing," unquote. So again, yet another piece of mythology of Mussolini's corporate state. It should be noted, too, that today American journalists are still noted for frequently writing or presenting to their readers a perspective that essentially is to be gleaned from hanging around the lobbies of some of the higher-priced hotels in some of the capital cities, and correctly, the American press is often accused of not accurately representing the situation due to the fact that basically the journalists, the correspondents, reflect the perspective from a cushier side of life than one would normally expect to get, one would expect to experience in many of these countries. That was certainly true of Mussolini's Italy. We're going to take yet another musical break, then I'm going to come back and sum up what we've looked at in the broadcast this evening, and we're going to conclude with a haunting look at contemporary America. I'm going to sum up this evening what we've looked at in the broadcast on Mussolini's corporate state. Specifically, tonight's archive broadcast is entitled Uncle Sam and the Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. And again, I want to apologize for people that eventually hear this on tape. In February of 1990, when I'm recording this, I'm doing it with a bit of a head cold, so if that comes across on the tape, well, my apologies, but it ain't fatal, neither to me, obviously, nor to the broadcast per se, but I just have to ask your indulgence under the circumstances if I sound a little bit submarine. Now, I'm going to take some time now to sum up, review what we've looked at, because we've looked at a lot of information, and then I'm going to leap from the past to the present, I guess you could say. We began by taking a look at a column by conservative columnist George Will, decrying George Bush's budgetary chicanery, which he is basically using budgetary surpluses from Social Security to mask the continued high budget deficits. We then took a look at Mussolini's prescription for the corporate state from his book by the same name. We then took a look from George Seldes' Facts and Fascism at how fascism, what George Seldes described as a spoil system, benefited the top industrialists and financiers who had supported Mussolini in the first place. We took a look at the kidnapping and assassination of socialist deputy Giacomo Matteotti, who was the person who did the most to publicize Mussolini's backing of big business and subsequent rewarding of big business. We took a look at how the American press looked with favor upon Mussolini. We also took a look at how Mussolini was made an honorary member of the American Legion in 1935, the American Legion being very close to the U.S. National Association of Manufacturers. We then took a look at one of the main reasons why American industrialists and financiers looked on Mussolini with favor, namely the myth of fascism as an antidote to Bolshevism. In addition to the enormous profits generated by the corporate state, American industrialists and financiers were attracted to fascism by its anti-communist political philosophy. We then took a look at how that support, that political support by American industrialists and financiers, translated into an enormous floating of American capital in order to finance Mussolini's budget deficits. Basically, an enormous number of bond issues were floated by American lending institutions in order to help compensate for the corruption of fascism, which was to result in budget deficits, in a manner reminiscent of the way Reagan and Bush basically mortgaged the United States to foreign capital in order to finance their military buildup. Mussolini, too, used much of the borrowed capital to help build up his fleet, which, of course, was used for the purposes of making war, not for making the Italian economy more competitive. Again, not an exact, but an appropriate and significant analogy for our purposes. We then took a look, too, at how Mussolini propagated the myth of the balanced budget in order to help justify the continued expenditures by the American in the American capital market by those who purchased the Italian bonds. Basically, Mussolini, in a manner reminiscent of George Bush and Ronald Reagan, used budgetary chicanery. He used budgetary BS. He used the cooking of the book, so to speak, in order to create a myth, and a myth is what it is, of a balanced budget. Just as Ronald Reagan has been able to successfully portray himself as a reducer of government spending, whereas he is the biggest deficit spender in history, so Mussolini, a big deficit spender, was able to portray himself, with the aid of a sympathetic American press, as a budget balancer, whereas he was anything but that. We took a look at how the American press helped cover for his myth of the balanced budget. We then took a look, too, at how the American press helped cover for the Mussolini mythology of an improved standard of living for the average Italian. In fact, the average Italian worker experienced an enormous reduction in his or her standard of living under fascism. Mussolini, in fact, represented things as being the opposite, and the American press went along with him in doing this. We then took a look at how the myth of fascism as an antidote to Bolshevism was propagated. Even Mussolini himself admitted that Bolshevism in Italy declined due to a number of factors before fascism came into power, and that fascism was not one of the factors that neutralized Italian Bolshevism. We then took a look at how the American press continued to propagate the myth of fascism as an antidote to communism or socialism, in spite of the fact that, by Mussolini's own admission, other factors neutralized Bolshevism in Italy. And we then took a look at the most enduring but perhaps least significant piece of the mythology of the fascist corporate state of Mussolini, namely the myth that Mussolini made the trains run on time. He didn't make the trains run on time. The trains only ran on the trains were only disrupted because of the First World War and the priorities of routing troop and munition trains to the front. The liberal regime which followed the war successfully repaired that. Mussolini took credit for that and helped cover up the fact that his fascist economic policies actually caused inefficiencies in the Italian rail system. And again, I'm not suggesting in any way that the analogies between Mussolini's corporate state and the pro-business regime or government of Ronald Reagan and now George Bush, I'm not suggesting they're exact analogies, but I think they are significant and valid. Also, more than a little scary for our purposes. I'm going to conclude the broadcast this evening, or the prepared portion of the broadcast, by rereading a column which I read last week. This was a column which appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, January 26th of 1990, It's by Richard Lamm, L-A-M-M, former governor of Colorado. And Richard Lamm basically is musing on the future of America's corporate state and the ultimate paying of the piper. And again, it's worth musing on history here to take some lessons for the future. Richard Lamm writes as follows. America faces a self-imposed day of reckoning. We have planted the seeds of decline, and we shall harvest the results. While the results could be minimized, they cannot be avoided. We have made too many mistakes. Our excesses are too deep. Pipers shall have to be paid. What will this day of reckoning look like? It could take any number of forms, yet it is instructive to speculate to show the magnitude of the crisis. I suspect that the first trauma is an economic one. A deflation in real estate, for instance, undermines the housing market and simultaneously a number of financial institutions fail. We already are experiencing record bank and savings and loan failures. A drop in the price of real estate could push a number of other financial institutions, other banks, S&Ls, and insurance companies into insolvency. Next, a number of government guarantees would be activated, requiring massive infusions of new money from a Congress already running record budgetary deficits. Our safety nets, quote-unquote, put in place by Congress to provide stability, become the next point of instability. FDIC, Federal Home and Farm Mortgage Guarantees, Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae, Federal Pension Guarantees, all the safety nets, quote-unquote, will require massive infusions of money that will either, one, be beyond the ability of Congress to fund, or, two, require it to massively inflate the dollar. At this point, when the economic chickens come home to roost, our past excesses severely limit our options. The United States, which is the world's largest debtor nation and has massive federal deficits, does not have the options that it did in 1930 when it was a creditor nation with small federal debts. We do not have available the Keynesian solutions that we did in the 1930s. Any hint that we would inflate our currency would cause a massive outflow of foreign money. We will now see that foreign investment, quote-unquote, has been an economic steroid, a growth hormone that does more harm than good. We have lost our economic sovereignty, and our foreign creditors can and will compound our problems by calling home their money. This will cause a massive deflation of the dollar. We will be faced with a Hobbesian choice between defaulting on a number of government instruments or causing a massive run on the dollar. The federal deficit will soar. In the last recession, the deficit increased 2.7 times, and it will soar even more during the next recession. U.S. corporations, undermined by massive debt, will experience record bankruptcies, as will consumers who have also accumulated massive debt. A credit-based boom will end in a credit-based bust. We have all been consuming more than we produced, and we shall pay dearly for these excesses. Massive instability will result as Americans look for scapegoats. We will not want to look at our own excesses, so we shall turn upon our neighbors. The tensile strength of our social system will be severely tested. Massive tensions will develop between the races, between labor and management, between citizens and their government, between young and old, between those holding jobs and the unemployed. The tragedy is that all of this will be self-imposed. We did not react early enough to the demands of the new world marketplace. Every generation of Americans until my generation left a more prosperous and competitive economy to their better educated children. My generation left a less competitive economy, encumbered by massive debts, to their less educated children. That last sentence again. My generation left a less competitive economy encumbered by massive debts to their less educated children. History will not be kind to such generational malpractice. Well, history generally isn't too kind to much of anything or anybody. However, it's worth studying because, again, it provides us with lessons from the past for the future. And although, as I said many times during the broadcast, I'm not suggesting that the analogies between Mussolini's Italy and Reagan-Bush America are exact, I think they are valid, and I think they are significant and worth studying for that reason. As philosopher George Santayana noted, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. Or as philosopher Dave Emery says, what goes around comes around, including and especially in the corporate state.
That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.